Gentlemen, our first case for this morning is ADT Security against Lyle Woodridge Fire Department, Protection District, I should say. And you must be Mr. LaPointe.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This Court previously issued a mandate ruling that the Lyle Woodridge Fire District has the authority to require direct connect, has the authority to require wireless radios. This Court also ruled in its prior opinion that the district does not have the authority to be the sole provider for transmission equipment, and it cannot charge for connecting to the board under the Illinois Fire Protection District Act. So what did the district do in response to this mandate, to this court's mandate? Just 4 months later, it heeded this court's mandate. It repealed the old ordinance, which is the center of this lawsuit, and replaced it with a new ordinance.
Explain to me why putting the district station number 3 in the middle of this process doesn't actually make central stations equivalent. It seems to me you have a building that has a problem. The first signal gets transmitted to point A, which you want to be station number 3, but it could be a central station, and then it wirelessly gets transmitted to DUCOM. So I don't understand how this insistence that it go through station number 3 fits in with anything that we've been talking about here.
Well, Station 3 is part of the remote supervising station model.
Well, but why is that different? Why, from a technical point of view, if there's going to be an intermediate stop, why is it any different if it's a central station or if it's station number 3?
Because in the central station model, there's no T1 line, no direct tie-in to the dispatch center.
But you insisted that it all be wireless. You insisted that it be a T1 line, they would have put a T1 line in.
Well, the wireless part, Your Honor, is from the radios within the district to Station 3. And because DUCOM is situated outside the district, we can't set it up where DUCOM will receive those signals directly. We have to set it up within the district where the Station 3 within the district receives those signals wirelessly.
But that's not what the central station people said. They said they could get it to DUCOM wirelessly.
Well, that's with the automatic retransmission. But the problem with that, Your Honor, is that we're talking about dozens of alarm companies that would, you know, try to connect to DUCOM. There's no technical means by which that DUCOM can receive all those different signals from all these different alarm companies.
I don't understand that at all. And I actually also don't understand why a T1 line, which is, in a sense, old technology, is better.
Well, all the radios are connected to the board in Station 3. And that's the by wireless radios. And from there,
they could all be connected. They're all connected to central stations, too.
They could be, but the NFPA 72 allows the district to elect a remote supervising station model rather than a central station model, which the district has done.
This completely destroys your argument about the single transmission to DUCOM. There is no single transmission to DUCOM. It goes through an intermediary remote station under your model.
Your Honor, the testimony at the hearing was that this is just a pass-through. It really is the same transmission.
Was that what the district court found?
No, that's not what the district court found.
That's what we're dealing with. Let me ask you, if I could,
sure,
Mr. LaPointe, about your attack on the district court's compliance or lack of compliance with our mandate. The district court's prior permanent injunction that we reviewed last year was based on a grant of summary judgment, correct?
That's correct.
In which the district court was required to treat the district's evidence as true.
True.
As to motives, compliance, technical skill, capacities, and everything else, right?
Yes.
And is it your belief that we intended with our mandate to prevent the district court from actually finding out what the facts were?
No. That's not our position,
okay,
Your Honor. at the hearing in May of 2012,
mm-hmm.
many of the facts that we tried to introduce as far as motives, reliability of the old system, we were not allowed to do. That hearing in May of 2012 was supposed to be to determine alternative means to connect to the board. And in fact, what happened is that the whole process got hijacked by introducing all this evidence which attacked, not only presented evidence, the plaintiffs presented evidence that there's all these other systems out there that could be introduced, but also attacked every aspect of the district's own system.
And you weren't ready for that?
I'm sorry?
You were not ready for that?
Well, we were ready for it. We rebutted it as best we could.
Okay. Let me ask another economic question. With respect to the new model that you wanted to adopt with your new ordinance in the summer of 2012, since the district and DUCOM cannot charge fees for residents of the district, what money was supposed to change hands under this system?
Well, DUCOM is not a fire protection district, so it's not governed by the Fire Protection District Act.
Is it your belief that DUCOM, DUCOM is just an agent for the district. Is it your belief that you can charge your residents fees through DUCOM?
No, we're not charging anything, Your
Can
Honor.
DUCOM charge them
DUCOM
fees?
DUCOM can, because it's not a fire protection
says
district.
Says who?
I'm sorry?
Who says they can do that?
Because they're a separate entity, legal entity, and they are not governed by the Fire Protection District
How
Act.
Are they a separate legal entity?
DUCOM is here to speak today about their separateness, but they are a separate legal entity.
But if you require the use of DUCOM and DUCOM charges a fee, why isn't that the same as you charging the fee?
We don't collect anything. We're out of
I know you
the
don't
process.
Collect it, but you require that it that DUCOM be used, and DUCOM requires it for transmission to their facility.
But I think the real issue here is, where is the prohibition? Where does the prohibition lie as far as charging customers?
No, the question is, where is the legal authority? We're talking about you don't have DUCOM doesn't have home rule powers, does it? Whatever it is.
Right. Whatever. Right. That's exactly right.
So what gives it the authority to charge fees for services that people pay taxes for?
Well, DUCOM has the authority to charge for its services. They're providing a service.
Where are you citing? I mean, what law are you citing to support that? I'm looking at DUCOM's brief, and they can make and enter into contracts. They can employ people and so on, but under Illinois law, they need to be able to charge people, and I just don't see where they're entitled to be the mandatory provider of services.
Well, again, DUCOM's attorney is here to speak on that, and I'm sure they can answer that question.
You understand what Judge Hamilton,
Judge Tender,
is saying. If you're just putting your agent in between yourself and the customers, why isn't that in violation of your powers?
But as I understand this court's opinion previously, in addressing the fee issue, the charge issue, there are two questions raised by this court. One is, does this charging of fee by the district, because they're in the business themselves, in this case $66, does that impose some kind of impediment for the other alarm companies to be in the business, be in the alarm monitoring business? Well, we've taken care of that part, that question by this court, by exiting the alarm monitoring business altogether. The other part...
Well, you've lateraled to DUCOM. Does DUCOM have a contract with Chicago Metro?
No.
Okay.
But
why does DUCOM have essentially taxing power? I just don't see that in the intergovernmental agreement concept. Sure, it can facilitate cooperation among all these districts. That's a great thing. It's lots of little municipalities. But where can they do this?
Well, again, DUCOM's attorney is here to speak on that. I'm sure he can answer that question, Your Honor. But there's no statute that prevents them from charging for their services.
Well, that may not be the relevant question. The question may be what statute affirmatively permits them to do so.
That's true. That's true, Your Honor.
And but, you don't know of anyone, so I will just take that for right
well,
now.
The important point, Your Honor, I think is this. The Fire Protection District Act, as your honors found before, doesn't allow the district to charge its residents. We're not charging the district or the residents of the district. And so to the extent that DUCOM is charging, they're not a fire district. They're not a fire protection district governed by the prohibition under the Act. So with the new ordinance,
I'm a little curious about the timing of the new ordinance. You say it didn't go well for your client at the May hearing, and you're ordered after the hearing to submit proposed findings and conclusions, and this new ordinance rolls in, what, just 3 or 4 days prior to the deadline for those?
The timing really had nothing to do with briefing, the post-hearing briefing. It was just kind of happenstance as far as the timing of the passage of the ordinance.
After you all got extensions of time to respond to the proposed order?
Well, I can assure, you know, Your Honors, that passing this ordinance had nothing to do with the hearing in May. It had nothing at all to do with the hearing in May. We were considering amending the ordinance or repealing the ordinance altogether.
Was the court ever informed of this?
No.
Surely these are public acts.
Yeah, don't you have to send notices in advance of issuing ordinances or
agendas, public notices of meetings?
The public notice was disseminated just like any other meeting, and that was done. And, you know, the alarm companies didn't show up to the meeting, so that public notice was done in accordance with the law. But as far as informing the court in advance, no, we did not. The court, Judge Shader, in fact, did say after this enactment of the new ordinance that we had indeed the authority to enact this ordinance. So there's no question about that.
You have the authority to enact an ordinance.
Right. Understood. So the new ordinance, under the new ordinance, the district has exited the alarm monitoring business altogether. There are no district-owned or leased transmission equipment.
But you're still insisting that people use this one type of transmitter, even though the district court finds that other transmitters would also work.
Not for this system, Your Honor. There are actually two types of radios that would fit here, the AES and the Keltron radios.
It's the same thing.
The
it's a private label, right?
Yeah, so that's true. But those but those radios are the superior product on the market for this type of network system. All these other radios and so forth that were introduced at the hearing in May, last May, rely on systems, phone lines, and other types of instrumentalities that are not completely integrated on its own. This is the only network that is completely on its own. It's reliant within a mesh.
Very confused on. I know I'm kind of jumping from one part of technology to the other, but you don't even have a public safety frequency for your system. You're on some commercial frequency.
Well, as far as we're concerned, the FCC license was the appropriate license here, and if
the district judge disagreed, why is he wrong?
I understand. I don't think he was wrong. I think the FCC license that was introduced, and the first one that was introduced by the plaintiffs, was the wrong, in fact, wrong license. But the true license that was introduced by us is, in fact, the appropriate license, we believe.
But you're the only people in the country who have this kind of, public safety frequencies are reserved so that they can be used for public safety needs, right?
Right, that's right.
Commercial frequencies can be very crowded. You were worried a little while ago about DUCOM not having enough capacity to accept 3 or 4 transmissions from central stations. I don't see why you don't have an even bigger problem.
But if there's any issue about the FCC license and whether the proper license was being used here, that's a simple fix. That can be corrected very simply. but it should not be the subject of a permanent injunction barring us from having this. And we're talking about a new ordinance here. They attacked the FCC license that was being used under the old system, which has now been totally dismantled.
But the problem with the new ordinance is that it perpetuates a number of the issues that existed under the old ordinance, too, including the use of this 703 board at Station 3. And it's actually not a complete fix.
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor, because if you look at now, the district uses the 2002 version of the NFPA 72.
I understand that. How does Ordinance 1208 address the district court's concern that your fire board is not, in fact, compliant with NFPA standards? It's not parallel to them. It's not satisfactory.
Well, the district court and the plaintiffs have argued that Station 3 is a subsidiary station. But subsidiary station is a term of art that applies to central stations, not remote supervising stations.
You haven't pointed to any other language in the NFPA that covers your situation. You seem to be thinking that as long as the NFPA is silent, you can do whatever you want. You can have Pony Express.
I can point to it right now, Your Honor.
You didn't.
Under 8.4.2.1.2. I'll just repeat that because I know it's a long number. 8.4.2.1.2. That section of the 2002 version of the NFPA 72 says that the regulating authority may provide for an alternate location. Those are the words used in that code section, alternate location for receiving the signals. Well, that's exactly what Station 3 is. It is an alternate location.
You don't think it's a subsidiary facility?
No, not within the
different from subsidiary.
And is it subject to any technical requirements for reliability?
Under 8.4. And under 8.4, it provides that this is 8.4.1.3, again, 2002 version, says that the remote supervising station physical facilities and equipment shall comply with the minimum requirements of Section 8.4, which, of course, is what we're talking about, the remote supervising station model.
But what are those requirements? What your opponents argue is that once you clear away the brush, it's actually the same as the requirements for the subsidiary stations.
But it's not. Because if you
you're under less constraints, you can have sort of an inferior remote supervising station.
Well, if you look at I wouldn't say that, Your Honor. I wouldn't say it's inferior. But if you look at the difference,
of course you wouldn't. But why do you think it's so different to call it alternate or remote?
If you look at 8.4, the language of 8.4, which is the remote supervising station sections, and then you compare that to 8.2, which is the central station model. Under 8.4, there's a lot of deference given to the regulating authority, the authority having jurisdiction. Well, that's the district, and it makes sense.
That doesn't tell me very much, because suppose the district was in straitened budgetary circumstances, and it said, really, we just can't afford to do very much, so we're going to have this remote station, but we're not going to use a secure frequency, and we're not going to, we're going to just have phone calls from there to DUCOM. If there's discretion, there's discretion, and you're trying to persuade us, basically, that the discretion is being well exercised, but it's not clear that that's right, and it's not clear to me how much leeway the district has to deviate from these general standards in the code.
Well,
whichever code the district, I understand the district has the discretion to adopt the version of the code it wants to. There are plenty of antitrust cases about this kind of code adoption by municipalities.
If you look at 8.4 again, it talks about power supplies. That's one element of the requirements of 8.4. and that they must comply with Chapter 4, having primary and secondary power supplies. In this case, the district has two secondary power supplies. So it has three systems, redundant systems, for power supplies. So that complies with 8.4. It also 8.4 also talks about transmission means, and that they must comply with 8.5.
There's 8.5, and your opponents have said 8.5 is referred to, too.
8.5 does not talk about central stations. It's a section which talks about supervising stations generically.
Right, and that's what you're saying. They say it is, and you say it isn't.
But, Your Honor, that what that talks about is transmission means. The words that are used there, transmission means, has nothing to do with Station 3 and whether it's a subsidiary station. It talks about transmission means. And there's been no attack. There's been no attack whatsoever, a challenge, to the transmission means, in this case wireless radios, being used here.
So Station number 3 is subject to what requirements with respect to redundancy and being able to get back online when there's trouble?
And there's also one more provision that applies, Your Honor, and that's retransmission of signals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because 8.4.
And what is the answer to my questions?
I'm sorry. I thought
question
I was answering
is,
it.
No. If you don't think 8.2 applies,
right,
then tell me what requirements, if any, apply under 8.4 for redundancy, reliability, getting back online when there's trouble.
Okay. 8.4 does talk about power supplies, that the power supplies must comply.
That's okay. That's one thing.
That's one thing.
That doesn't tell me what happens if your board blows.
Okay. So that's power supplies. It also talks about transmission means, which, again, there's been no challenge to the transmission means being used here, the wireless radios. Next, it talks about retransmission of signals.
Are you telling me there are no requirements, then, with respect to redundancy and being able to recover from trouble?
Well, that's what power supplies is. The power supplies section, which is Chapter 4 of the 2002 code.
No. I'm asking about, is there something parallel to the requirement in 8.2 about, in the event of failure of equipment at the subsidiary station or the communications channel to the central station, a backup shall be operational within 90 seconds. Now, I understand you're saying that doesn't apply. Is there some comparable requirement?
I believe under Chapter 4 it provides for that. Under the 2000...
Where's the 90 seconds part, for instance?
Or
I think your answer is no.
I don't think the answer is no, but I would have to look through and see that specific
provision.
That's
kind of a central question here, Mr. LaPointe.
Well, Your Honor, there are two redundant power supplies here. I don't think there's any question that this system complies with that 90-second rule. And that there's been no finding by this court, by the district court, rather, that this system does not comply with that 90-second rule. But if you go, again, back to 8.4, the other provision, as I mentioned, it specifies that signals may be received at an alternate location approved by the regulating authority, which we have done here, and that's Station 3.
Could you have approved a central station as an alternate station? Was that within your power, I'm saying?
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, I think that's kind of mixing apples with oranges.
I'm asking whether the Fire Protection District could have, in its discretion, said that a central station will be an alternate receiving station.
In that respect, it would be setting up a remote supervising station using a central station as the receiver.
Was that within its power? I know you didn't want to, but I mean, was that within its power?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the NFPA 72 has a line of demarcation between central stations and remote supervising stations.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, if I may carry that out to its extreme, if we had appointed one of the alarm company's central stations as the receiver of all signals, then are we not creating a monopoly for that?
I don't know why you jumped to all. I mean, it seems to me if central stations meet certain criteria, you could have as many as met that criterion.
But we've made a choice. We've made a choice to use a remote supervising station model because we believe it's better, because there's no human intervention.
And they were saying they could set up central stations also with no human intervention.
But they can't.
Well, the technology, we'll see what they have to say. You're out of time.
Not. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. So, Mr. DiNolfo, you represent DUCOM, as I understand?
I do, Your Honor.
Can you answer the question that Judge Hamilton was asking about your power to impose fees on people?
Yes, it's done through our ability. The contract is provided for under the Intergovernmental Cooperation Act. We enter into contracts with our member agencies, although there is no record.
Is the contract with the Fire Protection District, or is the contract with the various customers, the commercial buildings, the multi-unit apartments?
Our contracts are to both public and private entities. We contract with ADT, for example, for alarm monitoring.
Let's talk about an apartment building that's within the jurisdiction of the Lyle Woodridge Fire District. Okay, they're hooked up ultimately to your board. Whom do they pay?
The answer to your question with the question, which I apologize, it depends on where we are and what point in time. If we go back before this lawsuit all started, each alarm company contracted with DUCOM to have their alarms, in essence, monitored. They would call in, and DUCOM would monitor alarms. With the ordinance, there was what was called an opt-out agreement, where they opted out of the master services agreement and entered into a different agreement.
You're talking about the old ordinance, not 12-08.
Correct. So at that point, was DUCOM would contract with Lyle Woodridge for paying the monitoring those fees.
Now where are you, under 12-08?
Under 12-08, I believe they've opted back in, and I'm not, again, Your Honor, I'm somewhat lost in the proceeding because we didn't partake in the lower court proceedings.
Do you have contracts with Judge Hamilton's apartment building, or do you have contracts with Lyle Woodridge and your other districts?
The answer is we have contracts with other districts that are members of the agency, and my understanding, Judge, is, again, we weren't participating at the lower level to fully vet out this evidence. I don't believe we have direct contracts with each apartment building in the district. We contract with the alarm providers.
I think we understand that the Lyle Woodridge District and other member agencies can contract with you to pay you for the services you provide.
Correct.
Right? Do you have any other source of revenue for the alarm monitoring services you provide?
Specific to the alarm monitoring, DUCOM does collect monies through 911 surcharge that you see on your phone bill.
Taxes. Okay.
So the ETSB, the Emergency Telephone System Board, collects those taxes, and then DUCOM gets a portion of that money for its operations, both for alarm monitoring and dispatching.
Good. Okay. But the I don't understand yet how the economics of this system are supposed to work. Of what the district was trying to set up, without you charging fees to the apartment buildings and other commercial tenants and operations in the district.
Sure. I mean, the way it works is that the alarm companies, for instance, charge a monthly fee to their customers, and then that in turn gets transmitted and back with the district originally.
We've said the district, if it's providing these services, cannot charge fees.
Understood.
So
everybody's back with private alarm companies, is my understanding. But again, Your Honor, part of the problem with this whole proceeding was we weren't participating in the district court. So the court didn't have any information to allow us to present, to explain this to the lower court, how
the
system works.
Well, now is your opportunity.
Okay. So what we do, Your Honor, is that we have entered into basically a master services agreement with ADT and other alarm companies where we provide them access to our system so that we can monitor alarms. And quite often that's done through phone calls in from central stations where they call and say, we have a fire at 123 Main Street. There is a fee that is exchanged between the private companies and between DUCOM. At this point, it's my understanding that Lyle Woodridge does not provide any monies to us for, quote, monitoring those alarms. So that is how the economics work. And then we have other income from the surcharge that the ETSB provides to us from the telephone surcharge tax. That's the economics of how DUCOM survives.
Okay. I'm frankly mystified as to how this is supposed to work.
And DUCOM, let me just ask a different question. Under this intergovernmental agreement provision of Illinois law, DUCOM is an entity that can sue and be sued?
Yes, it's actually been sued in this district court before under employment laws.
Okay. And that's somewhere in your charter?
Correct. And as a matter of fact, I think the evidence of this case where the alarm companies were serving us with subpoenas for depositions and to testify in court supports the fact that they believe us to be separate as well. And we've entered into contracts with them. We have employees. We incurred debt. I see my time is up. But I believe we are a separate entity and not the alter ego of the Lyle Woodridge Fire District because they cannot control our day-to-day operations.
Any other?
No.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. DeNolfo. Good morning, Mr. Goldsmith.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The essential issue that governs this appeal relates to whether the district court followed this court's mandate. In that regard, the statements made by the district that they are out of the fire alarm monitoring business is totally inaccurate and totally inconsistent with the findings of the district court, which were certainly not clearly erroneous. They were very well supported by the record that was developed during the three-day hearing.
I want to tell you, Mr. Goldsmith, is that there are a number of provisions in this injunction, even if at a high level of generality what you say is true, that seem to me to go beyond the scope of what was properly before the district court. So to take a point we were just discussing indirectly with Mr. DeNolfo, the idea that the district in paragraph 4 of the injunction would have a legal obligation to direct DUCOM to cooperate in populating their system with this information about the commercial accounts strikes me as something beyond the district's legal powers to do.
Your Honor, the district directed DUCOM to populate its CAD with all the numbers of the accounts that the district was monitoring, and DUCOM did that. The Judge Shader was only following what had already been the pattern of behavior, and he only required them to seek the cooperation. He did not mandate that DUCOM do anything. And so paragraph 4 merely says, direct them to do what they already were doing for the alarm customers who were on the district's network prior to the time that they were enjoined from operating.
So it's the use of the word direct that concerns me. If it had said district shall request DUCOM to populate, et cetera, I'm looking at the injunction. This is not the only provision that I have issues with, but it's certainly one of them. It just seems to me, in light of the fact that DUCOM is not under the district's control, if DUCOM said, gee, we'd like to do this, but it's just not in our budget for this year, has the district violated the injunction? Has DUCOM violated the injunction? Has nobody violated the injunction?
The district has to ask. Whether DUCOM cooperates is something that depends on whether this court thinks DUCOM is the alter ego or whether it's a separate legal entity. And we'll get to that. But with respect to the actual implementation of the order, remember, this is what DUCOM was doing for the district in order for the district to have an operating network. And had the district been successful in creating the full monopoly, all 800 accounts would have been put on this same data system. In other words, all the information would have been populated on the CAD, and DUCOM would have responded to all the 800 commercial accounts. Our point is, all you're asking to do, and Judge Shader asked specifically Mr. Tegmeyer, the executive director of DUCOM, could they do this? And he said, yes, they could do this. You know, there was no question that it was capable of being done.
And your clients have proffered this information or have somehow indicated that they're ready to turn it over as soon as DUCOM's willing
Absolutely.
To put it in?
Yeah, it's alarm companies work with the 911 centers all the time. And one of the big confusions in this case has to do with what the district calls fire alarm monitoring and what really in the real world is fire alarm monitoring. Fire alarm monitoring is receipt of fire, trouble, and supervisory signals and taking appropriate action. That's what the code says as to every type of system that's set up. It doesn't matter whether it's central station-oriented, remote supervising station. The supervising and remote supervising station is taking appropriate action. That's not what happened here, and, in fact, that's what the district court found to be deficient. The trouble and supervisory signals were going nowhere. They went to DUCOM, but they weren't being handled by persons capable of taking the appropriate action.
Is there any evidence in the record about how expensive it would be or how difficult to create dual signals, you know, one signal going into that fire station, another signal going off to the central station?
The evidence, I believe, is in paragraph 80, and it specifically says that dual signals are not capable of being done under existing fire alarm systems.
But the question is, if it's not capable of being done under existing systems, it seems hard for me to believe that it's technologically impossible, but it might be really expensive, or it might be cheap, or it might be somewhere in between.
No, the testimony from Mr. Fiore, who was the technical advisor to NFPA 72 on these very issues, was that most fire alarm systems are not capable of providing dual transmission. And on the basis of that, the Judge Schitter accepted that, and you will find that in paragraph 80 of the injunction of the findings of fact.
Okay, Judge Hamilton had a question.
Yeah, I guess, Mr. Goldsmith, my concern is a couple of things. What's still pending in the district court at this point?
We have, depending on how this court feels about the finding on monopoly, we certainly would have a proof of damages under the monopoly claim, and we have the civil rights claims that would have to go to trial. And the case is positioned for that because Judge Schitter has denied every summary judgment motion that any of us have filed.
He's written a few things about summary judgment motions that I've read.
Well, we may be one of the ones who got lucky and got a partial summary judgment.
But it didn't last in its entirety up here. But how long, if we agree with the district court here, how long would this injunction stay in place? I'm frankly a little concerned about dependence on technical change, statutory changes that could occur, and there seems to be, frankly, some danger of having the district judge, in essence, become the fire chief.
Well, there's two answers to your question. The first is that, in fact, I was surprised that the district is relying on the 2002 code because, obviously, there have been significant advances in fire alarm monitoring since that time, and in fact,
you know, all sorts of codes are out there as raw material that municipalities may or may not choose to adopt, and there's nothing in any law that I'm familiar with that says every time a group like NFPA revises the code, every municipality in the country needs to, or, you know, every special district or whatever needs to rush off and adopt a new code. So if this district likes the 2002 version, I don't see where there's any legal obligation for them to change that.
I have two things, one of which goes to Judge Hamilton's question, and the other goes to your early comment about codes. This code says it supersedes all prior versions. So you have a problem
that's
with...
That's what the private... That's what the drafters of the code said. So it's just like, you know, the same thing happens with Article 9 of the UCC. The Uniform Law Commissioners toil away, and they change, and they approve Article 9. And some states say, we like the new version of Article 9, which supersedes the older versions. And other states say, for commercial stability or whatever, we're going to stick with the 1980 version of Article 9. It's completely up to the governing body to which it pertains.
Okay, but we have here a situation where they took wireless transmission as the sole means of transmission, a technology that's been in existence for 15 years. If they had followed through with it for the next 10 years, it would have been the technology. In the meantime, Mr. Fiore testified that there's cellular, there's IP links, there's all other kinds of technology that meets NFPA code and would not be allowed in the district. And that seems to be, and that's why Judge Shader also noted that there would be future technologies, including ASAP to PSAP, which is going to revolutionize this whole alarm business.
Now, why isn't the right thing to say, not that you're requiring the district to adopt any sort of code, but just you're telling the district you can't use the code as an excuse for monopolizing this business. You can't use the code as an exclusionary device. Now, if there's room under the 2002 code for these various technologies, so much the better. If there isn't, you know, you need to be flexible. But I'm very worried about paragraph 9, districts shall adopt the current version of the NFPA code and shall adopt such newer versions when they're issued. No fire protection district in the country is under that kind of obligation.
I understand your concern. So
saying don't use it as a subterfuge is quite different from locking in this.
It really goes to whether they can basically take arbitrary and capricious positions with respect to enforcement of their code.
Well, that's right. So you have an underlying concern, but I don't think that this injunction captures it. It's way overbroad. And it's also overbroad in paragraph 17, where it said they've been complaining about this all along in this lawsuit. District shall refund to the affected commercial accounts all monies collected. I can imagine that in a damages phase of this lawsuit back in the district court, you might complain about lost profits, which is actually your loss, not the commercial accounts loss. I could even imagine netting it out, but a wholesale refund seems to me quite unjustified.
The refund is not to the alarm companies. The refund is to the customers.
It's quite unjustified anyway. They've had monitoring during the period of time that the district was handling it.
If it were a private party, that might be the right answer. But quantum merit is not a right that a governmental body has.
The customers aren't even parties here, right?
Right.
The alarm companies.
Correct.
How can you argue on behalf of those customers that had service during the period of time?
Because this interfered with our business relationship with the customers.
That's a different argument, though. And I said, there's a lost profits measure of damages that one sees in such cases. And if there's a big commercial account somewhere within the jurisdiction of this district, as far as I know, the courts stand open. They could come in and they could complain that they made inappropriate payments. We don't know whether they would or not. But as Judge Tinder says, they're not here saying that right now.
But if you look at the impact from this time the first null and void ordinance went out, our customers have been inundated with all kinds of mixed information about how they're supposed to provide fire alarm service, which is a mandatory legal obligation of every owner of these 800 businesses. And one of the things they did by taking the revenue stream is not about our damages. It's about our business relationship with our customers.
And that's an item that you could prove, because some customers might have stayed on top of it. Some of them might just have bottom line. We just want to make sure the state's happy with our monitoring. I don't see how requiring the district to pay back every penny that the commercial accounts paid over to it is either something that you can equate to your business reputational losses, or how that actually even reflects real damages to the customers. Just seems like a mismatch.
But we have the same problem under the District Act.
Is there any testimony from any customer in this proceeding?
No. But what I was going to say is what we have is the same problem that we have with other exercises of authority that haven't been granted by the District Act. Clearly, they had no right to collect any money.
But they were, in fact, I mean, you know, if an account came in there, there's a concept of mitigation of damages that's very deeply embedded in contract law. And if they were getting monitoring, even though they were paying, it seems that there would be a netting out, just as there is if somebody says, I was wrongfully fired, and someone says, well, but what did you do with yourself in the meantime? You don't just get all the money.
I understand your concern. What I would like to do is is move to the statements that were questions you had about the station number 3. And in particular,
and can you explain while you're doing that what's the difference between a remote supervising station and an alternate station?
Yes. All right. First of all, you, as this court recognized in the original opinion, you have central stations, you have remote supervising stations, and you have proprietary stations. All of those are actually operated by private alarm companies, except for proprietary, which is actually a business that decides to operate its own fire alarm monitoring system. The difference between supervising stations and central station service under the code is that supervising, remote supervising stations are a lesser form of service than central stations. That does not mean that they're relieved from the obligations to have the necessary redundancy, to have competent operators, and everything else that's required to handle a fire alarm system.
So where in the code do those obligations, are those obligations stated for the remote supervising stations?
Well,
your opponent was quoting lots of things from 8.4.
He was, and I apologize, I brought 2010, which this court had relied on, but they're fairly similar.
Well, we'll take
where, before you get into that, yeah. Where are we going to find most conveniently in the record the relevant portions of the NFPA? It's not easy to find.
Many of the references in the findings of fact go directly to provisions in the NFPA code.
Right. Where do we find them? Where do we find the text in the district court record of the relevant NFPA provisions?
I think the text was included in an exhibit to the relevant text, but probably not all the provisions of the text. I mean, there was testimony as to what was, for example, the simple thing about this redundancy issue and the other things that that a remote station had, a subsidiary station had to have, are all in the code.
I don't mean to
delay
this,
this
further,
important.
But as a practical matter, somebody up here is going to have to write an opinion and is going to need access to the NFPA. And we don't have a budget, for example, that lets us go out and buy a full set of the NFPA. Where do we find it?
Well, we certainly can supply a copy. That's not a problem.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, if there's no full set of the relevant provisions of the NFPA, then it seems to me quite appropriate for the parties to agree on a version that should be submitted to this court and submit it within 10 days of this argument.
That's fine. There's no problem doing that. But I would note that in what is now Section 26.5, which was, I believe, what he was quoting from 8.4, there's a specific requirement that the owner of the premises certify annually that it has met all the requirements of the code. And that certification ties it back to Section 14 of the current code, which has a detailed requirement of testing and other requirements for the remote supervising station, which, again, is an owner's choice, not the government's choice, to provide service. So basically, in central station service, there's a heightened requirement of a whole series of things that have to be done, including really very rigorous response times when an alarm is out of service. And that goes back to your question about 90 seconds. They had no backup piece of equipment. The testimony at the hearing was it would take them a day or two at a minimum to make another unit available. The code requires it to be actually replaced by an alternate unit within 90 seconds, and the other one to be brought online with a matter of hours. So the notion that there is this oasis at station number 3, which has no rules and no requirements, is just totally fallacious. It's similarly the whole thing about the FCC licensing. The FCC licensing under public safety, they use extensively for their two-way radios, but they chose to take a license that Keltron issued to use for their station using a commercial industrial frequency.
But what's the practical difference? I mean, I understand the FCC divides spectrum up into various uses, but from a practical point of view, is it any worse to be using the commercial?
Mr. Fiore testified from extensive knowledge that it is a diminishment in the performance of the frequency because taxi cabs and cement trucks and other commercial users can be on the same frequency and interfere with the public
so
safety.
Too crowded, so it's slower, just like you have too many people.
Too crowded, or it could be impaired. That's why the FCC has public safety frequencies, and that's why the alarm companies have their own bands for their own central stations that are on a separate frequency within the commercial industrial, so that they don't piggyback on other frequencies.
So what about my other question? Mr. LaPointe said that if a trouble signal originated at a building and went to a central station maintained by any of the alarm companies, and then the central station transmitted it on to DUCOM, that DUCOM somehow would have trouble receiving signals from a number of different
central
stations.
That's a misstatement of fact. The district court found that DUCOM had the ability to receive alter means of transmission. They could receive automatic retransmission from central stations. Mr. Fiore actually designed and installed the equipment at DUCOM, which is in use, and he testified that that had not only it had the capability of receiving these signals from multiple sources, but it's required under the code to receive those signals.
And this is done wirelessly as opposed to T1 or...
It can be done any number of ways. The issue was... And I don't know why.
But is it done, in fact, the thing that you're just saying?
It can be done in a variety of technologies. Some are wireless. Some use IP links and other forms of communication. You know, we don't know anymore how a signal goes from point A to point B because there's so many different technologies that are in use. It might go by satellite. It might go by, you know, a cellular device. It may go by...
How's it going now for your customers?
Right now, the central stations are calling in and... saying we have a fire alarm.
It's a phone call. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
okay.
Which has been used for, you know, a long time.
Okay.
But technically, what I'm thinking about, and maybe this is not even relevant, but anyway, I'm thinking that if the trouble signal can go to district station number 3 and thence to DUCOM over the T1 line, why couldn't the trouble signal go to a central station and then to DUCOM with the same speed?
The issue is fire alarms, not trouble signals. DUCOM should never be getting trouble and supervisory signals because they don't do anything with them. They make an attempt to contract the customer, and that's it. They send an email back to the district, send a report once a week, and it's dropped there.
So the problem with the trouble and supervisory is just they're going to the wrong place if they're going... to the fire station.
They're essential parts of monitoring. And when we say that owner has responsibility for maintaining the system, which this court recognized in the first opinion, maintaining the system includes making sure that fire alarm monitoring is actually happening. And to happen, actually the alarm company has to receive fire, trouble, and supervisory signals.
Sure, so if the battery is bad at one of your locations, you need to know to go fix it so that if there is a fire, there'd be a proper...
And alarm. Under central station service, we're required to do it with like 2 hours. I mean, there's all kinds of rigorous requirements. And if it's more than 8 hours, we've got to tell the fire department that the system's out of service. That none of that happens in the district's model because those trouble and supervisory signals just die on the vine. And that's why we have findings that say that for weeks or months, there were systems out of service. That was is truly substandard operation, and that's why central stations perform much better than the model that the district adopted.
So let me ask you another question. I'm very troubled by the district court's decision to go through the old ordinance and to redline it and essentially rewrite it instead of taking as his starting point Ordinance 12-08, which everybody agrees the district had the authority to enact. I mean, they're a body that can enact ordinances. So why do we start with the old ordinance? It seems to me that's just wrong.
I guess the history was, of course.
Well, I know the history has been going on, and then this new thing got popped in. But
right. Well, so basically he took memoranda from each side on what did the new ordinance do and was it compliant. Then he issued a supplemental opinion, which is, I think, document 389, in that said it didn't cure anything because it perpetuated a monopoly over fire alarm monitoring.
But why does that enable him? I mean, one thing one could do is just simply tell the district to go back to the drawing board. I don't see why that authorizes him to sit down, take a red pencil to the old ordinance, and rewrite it. He's going to red pencil anything, you know.
Well, I guess you could redact the new ordinance.
Well, they both have severability provisions in them, right?
I understand. So,
I'm a little curious about that history, though. Was this new ordinance a bolt out of the blue?
Absolutely.
There had been no mention, no discussion whatsoever.
No, the district court.
Your client saw no notices of of hearings regarding?
I mean, we don't spend time looking to see every notice of every meeting that they sent out. Okay,
it's a subject you're pretty interested in.
Well, I wouldn't have thought there was an issue. We waited 5 weeks to get to our hearing. We waited 5 weeks to get submissions into the court, and nobody ever said, you know, by the way, all this time we've been thinking about a new ordinance.
That's just hard for me to appreciate that you guys would be fighting so hard about this all along, and then out of the blue, this ordinance.
That's exactly what happened.
I think that's why the district judge was so upset about it.
Yeah, so I can imagine.
You know, I mean, he had invested a lot of time to hear us out and get a full record. Then he asked for submissions, and it wouldn't surprise the court that the submissions were totally, they were just so far apart. So then, you know, he had to do something. And then all of a sudden this ordinance shows up. And it's really a plea for, I mean, it's a great sales job for Keltron equipment. Now all of a sudden everybody's got to buy Keltron equipment, still send the signal the same place, still end up with the same result. When it gets to DUCOM, nothing happens to trouble and supervisory. So the poor customer still doesn't have fire alarm monitoring. And to add insult to injury, you have a situation where we just restored contractual relationships with all 800 customers, and now they're being told that they can't have fire alarm monitoring anymore. So you have to avoid...
Would the new ordinance prohibit your clients from adding on the central monitoring functions that would allow you to get the trouble and supervision?
Well, they have this vague language about alternate equipment and methods. But we have a history of 3 years in the litigation where they've never allowed anything other than their own system. And we've always had automatic retransmission as a capability, and we know that DUCOM had the ability to receive it.
You know, I see what you're saying about DUCOM not doing anything with those other things other than fire, but why can't you kind of grab that information off before it goes?
Because the way they set up the system, you have to automatically send the signal from the customer's premise to station number 3. So and you have to send fire, trouble, and supervisor, which once you send one, you have to send them all. So once they get them, it goes to DUCOM. So we're out of the
but
loop.
But then signals, it's not an item that disappears. I mean, you can.
Yeah, no.
Why can't it go two places? I don't understand that.
That was the finding in paragraph 80. It can't go two places because most of the equipment does have the capability. It's not like it's just out there and you can pick it up anywhere.
The technology apparently has not been designed for this kind of parallel private and public.
No,
system.
Not at all. I mean, the whole idea of the network is the way these radios work is they send a signal, it bounces off a series of other transmitters, and eventually gets to wherever the destination is. And then in our case, the destination is the central station. In their case, the destination is station number 3. So there's no way to get that signal going, and you know that we could snap the signal up off the air and just follow up with our monitoring.
Mr. Goldsmith, let me just share a thought with you and get your reaction to it, if I could. It seems to me that in our decision last year, what we were trying to do was balance between two different things. Legitimate regulatory authority for the district over fire protection mechanisms of all kinds, and complying with limits on the district's legal authority under Illinois law and prohibitions on monopolizing what had been competitive markets. We tried to, in essence, straddle that tension. It seems to me that what the district court found on remand is that as a result of current technology, the regulatory requirements that the district is trying to impose would simply inevitably produce that monopoly for the district. Is that a
yes.
fair assessment?
And in addition, we could, if the legitimate aim was to get the status of all the alarm systems in the district, mm-hmm. we could have given that information after the central station got it directly to the district, mm-hmm. which they've declined to take.
Okay.
So if they really were interested in the status of the systems, they could have all that information through an email.
As you understand the system proposed under the 2012 ordinance, the new ordinance, who is supposed to pay whom for what services?
It appears the customer is going to pay DUCOM,
And, okay, maybe you had earlier alluded to wanting to talk about the status of DUCOM, and maybe
yes,
this is
I
a
do.
Good time.
And, well, first of all, there is no statutory authority for DUCOM. Its existence is derived from the intergovernmental agreement. So to the extent that they stand up here and say we're a separate legal entity, Illinois law is quite clear on that point.
So it's the Joint Public Safety Communications System Agreement that has the provision about make and enter into contracts, et cetera. It's not an Illinois statute or regulation.
No, we've found none, and they've cited none.
They can enter into voluntary contracts, but there's nothing that gives them the right to say to every commercial owner in the district, you've got to have a contract.
And they don't do it that way. I mean, the way this system operates is they use the fire district to, in fact, enforce their right to get money, which is kind of odd because they have a tax source. And the question is, why do they feel it necessary to...
If DUCOM does not cooperate as this injunction directs, do you go back to Judge Shader and seek to have DUCOM held in contempt?
Well, I think we would have to probably have an intermediary step of getting DUCOM the information that's required.
Well, of course, but then if they don't cooperate.
Well, I mean, under Rule 65D, I think that the court has a right. They're actually in privity with the district, regardless of what their legal status is, and therefore
because the district is a member, even though it's not a controlling member.
Yes, because they have a contractual relationship and they're responsible to the members. The real question is, why didn't the district, as the new ordinance, just ask for automatic retransmission? This would have been a simple resolution of this whole case, but instead they have to maintain
automatic retransmission from the central station to DUCOM.
Yes.
Yeah.
I see my time's up.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Goldsmith. Anything further, Mr. LaPointe? Did his time run out? Well, I'll give you a minute, too.
Okay. Just real quickly, Your Honor. As far as the FCC license, that has no bearing on the new ordinance. There is no FCC license at all required under the new ordinance because the district is not doing wireless monitoring at all. As far as the question posed before about the 90-second requirement on backup systems, again, 8.4 references Chapter 4 as far as power supplies. And under 4.4.1.6.2, that talks about, or that specifies, the secondary power supply shall automatically provide power to the supervising station, facility, and equipment within 60 seconds.
That's power supply, not the board itself, right?
That's the secondary power supply. So if the primary power supply goes out...
The answer to my question is that's right. You're not referring to the system itself.
That's correct.
So when you submit the actual text of this code, I think it would be useful for the court to have the 2002 version, and if parties wish also to point us to any later version, that's fine, but for us to be able to follow the arguments effectively, I think, at a minimum, the 2002. Would you all agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yes.
That's fine, Your Honor.
Including any provisions either side wants in there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We'll give you the whole code. We give you the 2010 and 2002 versions. Can I make one more comment, Your Honor?
Quickly.
Yeah, much has been made here about the fact that the district did not consult the district court as far as enacting this new ordinance and so forth. We firmly believed that enacting this new ordinance would resolve this lawsuit. That was our intention.
Okay, you've made that point. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We will take the case under advisement.